Go.
My apologies. I thought we had six, and then my page only has one on that page, and I forgot to turn. So my apologies.
We couldn't count either, Your Honor.
All right. John and, whoops. Yes, John and Jane Doe versus Zylstra.
Good morning. My name is Gene Boland. I represent John Doe. With me is Jules Butler representing Jane Doe. We responded to a motion for summary judgment in this medical.
Do you wish to reserve any time, counsel?
Oh, excuse me. I'll take five and reserve five.
All right.
Mr. Butler and I responded to a motion for summary judgment in this medical negligence action growing out of an illicit affair between a married medical assistant at an Arlington medical clinic and a longtime married patient that had been seen by all of the doctors in the clinic. In response to that motion, we filed two separate declarations from well-qualified experts in their fields.
Let us say at the outset, I'm kind of baffled by the approach you've taken in the opening and reply brief, in the sense that you're talking in the argument section about a lot of complex or sophisticated legal questions, but the legal authority you've provided us really is kind of boilerplate summary judgment, boilerplate elements of medical negligence, and that's about it. I mean, for example, here the critical question is, does a duty exist? And does the special relationship test apply? And you kind of haven't given us much to work with in terms of what authority.
And the authority is. I've represented clients in actions like this before involving illicit sexual conduct between a healthcare provider and patients. The law is clear. The WAC absolutely.
Where do I find the law you're talking about?
We cite the WAC in our brief, and I'll get it for you for my reply. But there's a WAC provision which specifically prohibits any illicit social or sexual contact between a licensed healthcare provider in the state of Washington and a patient or the receiver of those services. And the Department of Health enforces these rules. And it's very similar to the Bright Line RPC that was enacted in our profession 25 years ago, I believe now, prohibiting relationships, any kind of illicit or sexual relationships between attorneys and their clients. This is the medical parallel, and the WAC incorporates it. And Dr. Fassett, in his declaration, detailed line and page of the WAC violations that occurred in this case. And the
case tells us that there's a private cause of action for failure to protect or negligent supervision or whatever against third parties based on an individual's violation of that WAC.
Well, I don't think that's unless I've seriously misinterpreted the defense, I don't think that's the gravamen of the defense. Our experts have testified that from beginning to finish, there was negligent supervision, negligent hiring. These are well-established torts in the law in the state of Washington. And then, fundamentally, a failure to act once they knew or should have known that improper sexual activity was taking place between the medical assistant and his patient. Now,
is that based solely on the fact that there were these 45-minute patient interactions with Dr. Isham or Mr. Isham? Is that what would have caused them to know that there was something going on? Is there something else that would have given them some knowledge?
Yes, there is. The uncontroverted evidence in the case is that Mr. Isham's mail and his telephone calls were forwarded to Jane Doe's residence after the affair was begun. And Jane Doe and Mr. Isham also attended office functions where these licensed health care providers were present. Other medical assistants that worked in the office were present. And under the WACs, they each have a duty to self-report and to report others who they believe are in violation of these WAC provisions.
And this was all before March 16th? I mean, that was the date of separation, right? And so somehow they knew about this information before March 16th?
Well, I'm suggesting that they the very conduct of these two persons in the office, long extended visits and examination rooms that went beyond the allotted period.
Well, that's what I was asking. Is that that? But prior to March 16th, is you have anything other than that that to suggest that they had some knowledge?
I don't know if Jane Doe's declaration identified the dates on which she attended office functions. She attended at least one, I think, two office functions where other medical assistants were present. That occurred early on in the relationship, but I don't have a date for that. So the our opposition to the motion for summary judgment was predicated on the declarations. If I may, maybe I can take another minute, extend beyond the 5 minutes. The opposition to the motion for summary judgment was predicated on detailed testimony from my clients to the physicians, or excuse me, detailed declaration testimony and deposition testimony from my clients, supported by 40 pages of declarations from the two experts in the case, Dr. Fassett and Ms. Allen. And what's critical in the case is that the judge swept all of that aside. These are not just factual disputes. He engaged in weighing of the evidence. In our brief, we cite the minute entry in his court where he says, I'm taking these with a grain of salt. He engaged in a fact finder's function of weighing these declarations and the evidence. And stunningly, I've been doing this a long time. I've never seen a judge just sweep all of the evidence aside. That's what he did. My impression was that the judge didn't want to sully the reputation of the doctors.
Until you find a legal duty, they really aren't that significant until you find a legal duty, are they? Well, you can answer that on your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Amy DeLisa. I represent the respondents in this matter. There are a few issues I would like to address before the panel today with respect to the claims against these respondents. First, that the claims asserted by the appellants are, in essence, those of negligent hiring and supervision, which need to be brought against an employer under Washington law. None of these respondents were Mr. Isham's employer. Second, even assuming somehow these individual respondents could be deemed legally responsible, that there is no duty of care owed under these circumstances. And third, that the appellants cannot establish their required showing of proximate causation. Going back to the negligent hiring and supervision piece, the appellants have sued the 9 respondents who I represent, who are a receptionist, an office manager, a registered nurse, a referral coordinator, part-time float medical assistant, a physician's assistant, a medical assistant, and 3 physicians. And among the claims that are asserted against these individuals are those of negligent hiring and supervision. Washington law, we would submit, as described in our briefing, is clear that negligent hiring and supervision claims lie against the employer, which in this case would be the clinic. The appellants failed to sue the clinic here, and that failure is fatal to their claims.
Does it make a difference when a medical assistant has to, under state law, be supervised by a physician, and here there's a specific physician who signs up as the supervising physician?
I don't believe there is. I don't believe it does, Your Honor, and there's no case law that indicates that. And nothing cited by appellants in their briefing. Additionally, there's no Washington case which imposes liability against employees for the intentional acts of another employee, which is also sought here. Such a claim, again, if it's viable, lies against the employer, which is not a party to this case. Then we get to the issue of duty, because even if you assume that these individual respondents could be legally responsible as opposed to the clinic, the appellants cannot show under these facts that a duty of care was owed. The Kaltrider and the Smith cases, which are described in detail in our briefing, we would submit are controlling here. There's no special duty of care owed under these circumstances to protect an individual where that individual had no physical or mental disability and where the sexual contact, in our case, before Your Honors, occurred off-premises, off the clinic grounds. In fact, Ms. Kaltrider and Ms. Smith, the plaintiffs in those two cases, were arguably, even though they were determined by the Court of Appeals to be non-vulnerable, arguably they'd be more vulnerable than Ms. Doe. Ms. Kaltrider was in inpatient alcohol treatment. The Smith plaintiffs were in a psychiatric facility. Here, Ms. Doe is going to the clinic for her routine primary care, routine medical care needs. She was a competent, non-vulnerable adult, and she voluntarily, willingly chose to engage in an extramarital relationship with Mr. Isham. She presumably knew that there might be consequences to her marriage to Mr. Doe as a result of her relationship with Mr. Isham, and the fact that she seemingly regrets those decisions at this point does not create a duty of care as to these individual respondents. And then lastly, we get to the issue of proximate causation, which even assuming that a duty of care existed as to these individual respondents, there can be no showing of proximate cause in this case. The facts are very clear in the records before the panel that this affair began in February of 2009, and by March 16th of 2009, Mr. Doe was aware of the relationship. He had moved out of the marital home and that he and Ms. Doe were separated, and that's at Clerk's Papers 536. Per Ms. Doe's affidavit at Clerk's Papers 553, she was aware within a week or two of the start of the affair that it was against the law for Mr. Isham to have sex with her and that the clinic could be sued for it. But again, this knowledge, which she puts in her affidavit, did not stop her from continuing the extramarital relationship.
What's the significance of Dr. Hall learning about the circumstances from John Doe in June of 2009?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to that, we would, as described in our briefing, indicate that that did not trigger the duty to report to the Department of Health. There was no conviction, finding, or determination. Nevertheless, putting that aside, Mr. and Mrs. Doe had already separated by that point in time, and that's clear from the record before Your Honors as well. And even if a DOH report had been made, that would trigger presumably an investigation by DOH. They might decide to do an investigation with respect to Mr. Isham's certificate. They would have to have a hearing in order to take that away from him. Those types of actions does not necessarily equate to an end of his relationship with Ms. Doe. And I think the fact that their relationship ultimately culminated into their subsequent marriage in September of 2010 reflects that nothing would have changed if Mr. Isham, his license had been taken away by the Department of Health. It's our position that Washington law requires a showing of proximate causation and that speculation and conjecture are not enough to establish that element, and that's all that has been presented by the appellants here. So if there are no other questions, I would rest on the briefing at this point and request that the summary judgment dismissal as to these respondents be upheld. Thank you.
Your Honor, I'll take 2 minutes, if I may, and then Mr. Butler would like 2 minutes. What the defense is asking the court to do is to disregard or refuse to acknowledge any duty flowing from licensed health care providers to patients. This reminds me that I didn't find the WAC. The WAC site that I promised you a moment ago is contained in our opening brief, and it's also cited repeatedly in Dr. Fassett's declaration. It's WAC 246-16-100 sub 1, which provides a health care provider shall not engage or attempt to engage in sexual misconduct with a current patient, client, or key party inside or outside of the health care setting. Sexual misconduct shall constitute grounds for disciplinary action. And I represent that to the court that this duty extends not just as between licensed health care providers and the department, but it creates an ethical duty. And notwithstanding this, there is a duty for all health care providers in the state of Washington to refrain from any conduct which is detrimental to their patients. And this is certainly detrimental. The marriage was a sham marriage. I think that's discussed in the declaration. Mr. Isham said he, in his testimony, he couldn't recall offhand who he actually slept with on his wedding night with Ms. Doe. The evidence is uncontroverted. It is amazing to me that our experts cited 18 different violations of the standard of care combined. The defense provided none. There was not a single declaration asserting that they complied with the standard of care.
Could I ask you a quick question about that?
Yes.
Is this a medical negligence cause of action or a cause of action for negligent hiring and supervision? I mean, aren't they two different causes of action?
That's correct. It is. One other thing, the significance of the actual knowledge of the doctors is that they didn't do anything once they learned about it. That's corroborative that they didn't do anything when they should have known about it earlier.
I'm not sure you answered Judge Trickey's question. Which is it? Is it all of them, part of them?
They're separate torts.
And you're asserting all of them here?
Yes. And the court could dismiss or affirm the trial court on certain of those torts and deny on others. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Jules Butler representing Jane Doe. Just quickly here, the special relationship, there's two forms of special relationship. We contend that the special relationship exists between the respondents and Glenn Isham that provides the duty to protect third parties.
What authority do you have?
Well, I can... The authority that there is a that there are two forms is in Nice. Nice says that duty to protect third parties from harm from one another if there exists a special relationship between one defendant and third party or two defendant and plaintiff. Right? So there was a special relationship between respondents and Mr. Isham, as evidenced by the myriad rules and regulations, the signing off, Dr. Zilstra is going to supervise them. That locates the special relationship. Our expert has cited all of the different ways in which respondents were responsible for the health and safety of their patients. That seems to be undisputed, and at the very least, we ask the court to take notice of that. The proximate cause, one of the problems in this case at summary judgment is that proximate cause, the harm has been located at the commencement of the overtly sexual component of the relationship in 2009, about February 2009. We contend that the harm, the tort actually began when Mr. Isham began working with Jane Doe 12 to 24 months earlier, where, you know, in an intake session that should take no more than 10 minutes, he's taken upwards of an hour almost every time he sees her. And in a busy busy medical practice, where these doctors are waiting to see this patient, nobody's going to notice that there's a problem. Both of our experts say that they should have noticed. So we have.
And what should have happened at that point?
Well, at the very least, they should have not let him do intakes, right? So we say that but for them allowing to spend hours at a time with this patient over and over and over again, he would not have been able to groom this woman with a history of abusive relationships to get to not coerce her, but get her into a relationship. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you.